Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to Firehouse.com.
Well, welcome to Training and Tactics Talk. I'm your host, Douglas Klein, and today we're going to bring on board a great guest with us, Carl Smith from down in Georgia. But remember, on Training and Tactics Talk, we're focusing on making operations in the field and firefighters, giving them the information that we want to make the fire service and the culture of the fire service much safer out in the field so that everybody comes home. Today on Training and Tactics Talk, we're going to introduce engine company operations, and I want to introduce the guest that we have on board is a good friend of mine, and I've worked with him quite a bit over the last 4 years with the Southeast Association of Fire Chiefs. It's Carl Smith. He is the fire chief from Thunderbolt Fire Department, and he's been in that position for the last 15 and a half years, which Carl's not all that old when you start looking at it. He's got 25 years of experience into the fire service. He served as the president of the Southeast Association of Fire Chiefs, coming through the chairs of that rank. A little bit about his department, and the reason I have him on is we're going to kind of focus in between rural America and urbanized America when we talk about our training and tactics of engine company operations today. And Carl is the chief, again, of Thunderbolt Fire Department down in Georgia. They got 3 paid staff and 30 volunteers. And he's been involved with a lot of things across the United States in training. So, real excited about that. Carl, welcome on board.
Thank you, Chief Klein. It's a pleasure to be here.
Looking forward to a really good show today. I'm super excited about what we're talking about in Training Tactics Talk, and we've been working on a series of training and tactics and all the things that need to go in place, and we're going to talk about engine company operations. And, you know, there's always a saying, as a fire chief, I know you're very well aware of this, is that when we pull up on fire scenes or emergency scenes, the buzz phrase is the fire, the incident is going to go as first lines off the truck go. And would you agree with that, even though that we're different? I'm in a metropolitan area. As the perspective I'm taking today is being, you know, in the High Point Fire Department, you know, running a 70-square-mile district with 100,000 people and, you know, 14 stations versus where you have one station and pretty much a combination department.
Yes, sir, that's correct. We pretty much run out of one station and cover about 3 square miles, including a good mile and a half stretch of waterfront, heavy industrialized with marinas and yacht refurbishing companies and stuff. So very diverse from urban to commercial. Have a major university with about 5,000 students and faculty that covers about 8 acres, and it keeps us pretty busy over there as well.
And I guess you would agree with me when we say, no matter where we're at, when that first line comes off the truck or when we first arrive on scene, does that not pretty much dictate what it's going to look like for the rest of that event?
I think you're absolutely correct. I know there are some circumstances where you may end up doing something in the beginning only based on what is presented in front of you. In our circumstances, a lot of times we only have one, maybe 2 individuals pulling up on a truck at a fire scene. So what they do in that first couple of minutes really does set the table for what the other arriving volunteers will be able to do and what they need to do when they start arriving on the scene to be able to effectively mitigate any emergency.
One of the things that I know, riding as a company officer all the way up through the chief ranks, is that prior to initiating any fireground assault, one must consider strongly where you place that first arriving apparatus and make sure that it's going to be for a safe and effective attack. And, you know, apparatus placement, how many times do we see apparatus wrongly placed or maybe not strategically placed the best that it can possibly be? How many times have you seen that?
Quite a bit. Actually, we just had a pretty good working structure fire in a three-story condo a little over a month ago, and I had one of our new firefighters pulling in, and it was just one of those things, one of his first fires, and he practically pulled the engine all the way right up in front of the building, not seeing that it was the last unit of six other units, so that the fire would move just to one unit over, then the truck was pretty much sitting there right where the fire would have been. So it is definitely a consideration that we train our firefighters and our drivers, and in this case, and company officers, if you have a full crew, about taking the time to slow down when approaching, you know, a fire building, and taking a lot of things into consideration when they position themselves in front of a building. And sometimes that may not even be the right place to put your truck, is directly in front of a building.
And you're correct on that. One of the things that I relate back to, especially, you know, from years ago when I was an engineer on an apparatus and especially a company officer looking at pulling on scenes, is trying to get a three-sided approach. And we got to keep in mind, too, with our placement, and this is the hardest thing to get people, you know, focused in on, is, you know, you've got other apparatus, especially if you're the first arriving, that's got to get in there. You know, you may have the need for, you know, an additional engine with a secondary water supply, which is highly recommended in today's world. You know, the positioning of rescue or truck companies, those type of things. So leaving that front face open for truck access, you know, being an old truck company guy, you know, I definitely like that. For the fact that you pull past and get three-sided approach views is important. But we also need to stop and think, too, a little bit about just exactly what you described was the fire location and the type of occupancy and what could occur with fire behavior and movement. And talk a little bit about that incident there, Chief, with, you know, when he pulled up and the fire, you know, in these condos and the fast movement that it does in today's construction environment.
Yes, sir. Well, this is one of those instances where you couldn't pull your truck up and get three sides. You pretty much could only get pretty much a side picture from A, and then, of course, you had an exposure with the B unit, which was attached to five more condos from the street facing back. So if you're pulling in, the first five units were not on fire. The very back unit was the one that was on fire, and it was at a dead-end road. So there was no, you know, like the normal protocol, pulling up, going past, and trying to look at all three sides. You pretty much had to stop before you actually made it to the building. And in this case, like I said, our driver actually pulled up almost right in front of the fire, you know, just seeing the fire and all that. And then we had him back up a little bit. And that's when we began trying to at least pull off one 2.5 line. And then we had our second engine company that was coming in to catch the water supply and bring us a water supply. And we actually kind of made a little bit of a tactical error because we pulled the other engine in right behind the first engine. We don't have a ladder company at this time. We have to call for mutual aid for ladder companies, which we did a little bit into the incident, and we did get them there, and we were able to make room for them once they did show up. But that was one of the things we learned also, is because of the tight squeeze and the way your condos and apartments sometimes are laid out, once you bunch a couple of engines in there, you're pretty much stuck for the duration of the incident. So you really got to consider that a lot of times when your first companies are pulling in, to think about how they can make sure their trucks can get in, and if they have to, move out the way to let other trucks in.
Good point there. A couple other things I want to throw out is the overhead hazards. You know, oftentimes we'll pull in, and trying to keep that global picture in our minds is important, of the overhead hazards that exist, like trees or electrical lines, parapet walls, you know, things like that, and positioning, you know, so that we can do further into, when I think about tactics, the type of fire attack we're going to do. You know, are we going to be able to go to a defensive cover? Are we going to be able to engage in offensive, you know, aggression? Those type of things. And then the one that sticks out in my mind, because you're a coastal community, is the wind conditions. And, you know, on any given day, it's nothing for y'all to have a 5 to 10 knot wind, you know, coming off the waters. And that definitely affects things, correct?
Oh, yes, sir. We have a good part of our community that is right on the water and has clear wind tunnels from the water through some of our main streets. So we absolutely have days where we have a consistent 10, 15, 20 mile an hour breeze that does affect the amount of fire spread sometimes that we have, and fires that normally you could pull up to and would just be a single room involvement, but instead you already have positive pressure whether you really want it or not, because once it breaks through and has access through a window or something and you have a breeze, you pretty much do have another situation you're dealing with the wind pushing a fire through your building. And especially if it's on the opposite side from where the wind's coming from, you can have a lot of fire. We recently had another structure fire with a house call in an instance where you had flames, some of the wind was pushing flames 10 and 15 feet away from the building and towards other structures because of that, exactly. And in that case, this was a wide open road, and again, we had to use due consideration of actually pulling the engine all the way up to and get a three-sided view because of the fact that the street was narrow and there was so much fire and heat that there was really a danger of actually pulling your truck up and trying to even actually go past the fire because the setback for the house was only about 6 or 8 feet off the road.
You know, wind conditions down on the coast are obviously a problem, but when you get into downtown districts like what we have and what are in larger municipalities or, you know, downtown cities, you know, the wind patterns change very drastically based upon the designs and layouts of the footprints of these buildings. And with alleyways and roadways, you know, wind sometimes make some really different changes that we don't anticipate. So that's something that, you know, even if you're not on the coast or out on the plains to where, you know, you do have a big vulnerability to wind, we still got to take that in consideration. And a lot of people forget about that and when they get into the truly urban settings and how wind affects our behavior. So positioning does come into effect of that because, you know, the one thing we don't want to be is right in the middle of smoke. We, you know, we don't want our apparatus operators and folks having to stand there and you know, take that smoke or even having to put on, you know, SCBA while they're trying to run, you know, apparatus pumps and things like that. But that's something we don't typically think about as pump operators, but you know, it's no different standing outside breathing that smoke than it is being inside breathing smoke. So we need to take that into consideration. One other thing I want to throw out, and I've mentioned this before in some of the conversations, you know, that I've done teaching, and I want to see what your perspective is on it. One of the big things we're going to see very close in the next 4 or 5 years, I think, that's going to really change how we do business is the runoff potentials we have. You know, how much runoff problems are you going to have, and how is that going to affect us?
Yeah, I guess that is an issue that we especially, I take it you're referring to all the products coming from the building?
That's correct. I mean, this is going to become a very quick EPA issue. And, you know, what's your thoughts on this? You know, you served in a capacity to where, you know, a lot of this thought process is being addressed from, you know, larger, you know, organizations such as the Southeast Association of Fire Chiefs and towards IAFC, and especially with your involvement in Georgia on the Fire Chiefs boards there. You know, how's this changing, you know, potential setups and operations and thought processes? I mean, what do you hear?
We actually have a little bit of experience, mostly because the strict adherence to a lot of this with fire training is starting to spill over into the actual incidents themselves. For many years, we've really had a hard time actually doing live fire training because of a lot of the rigid standards that have been put in place by the environmental protection agencies and divisions. And one of the things now is, like, we're dealing with the Coast Guard and EPD a lot, and anytime we have really any incident near a waterway or where we're dealing with a lot of water that is running off and a lot of product and it starts dumping into a storm drain, we do have a process where we notify the EPD and the Coast Guard to make them aware that some of the product maybe going into the storm drains and going out into the water system. So it is becoming a big issue. I think it's just a matter of being of notification for the most part. You could foresee the day that we have to deal with structure fire, somewhat like hazmat incidents. And if you're putting a lot of water on a fire and you have a lot of debris and a lot of runoff, and you have a storm water drain somewhere near it, that you may end up having to treat it like a hazmat incident and block it off and not let any of the product in, and then clean up the product after the fire's over.
I think you're right on target with that, and it does stick out in my mind. I know of a couple of incidents, the Apex North Carolina incident with the chemical waste disposal company that they had that burned in the city, that created, you know, just really a whole new realm of how we're going to conduct business, I believe. I believe this is going to be one of those changing incidents, because they had to do air monitoring. They had to do water sampling and soil sampling. And I go back to one that sticks out in my mind, you know, several years ago when I was running as a battalion chief. You know, we ran mutual aid to a company, and we had to deal with the exact same thing of runoff, and we actually dispatched a hazmat team because of the amount of runoff we had. And it was a company that did have chemicals, but it was more the products that you would deal with every day for cleaning and office supplies, those type of products that we were dealing with. But when you start mixing several things together in runoff, and they're in concentrated forms, the molarity is, you know, up, you know, in their concentration, it does change the involvement. And we actually began, you know, operating in somewhat as a hazmat incident for one, air monitoring then, and water runoff. So I think you're beginning to see this. And moving into the second piece of this, you know, setup begins with that first arriving officer, and of course the size up I've talked about, you know, significantly, you know, in previous podcasts. But that first arriving radio report, when you're transmitting some of this stuff out of there and giving your size up over the radio, being able to, one, truly describe what you're seeing and painting that huge picture, I think is so important to other arriving companies, and letting them know what your action mode is truly going to be, sets the tone for how we begin going and giving assignments. I know for us, you know, the companies are rolling out about the same time. You know, we're dispatching, you know, three engine companies, a truck company or two, and depending on the structure it is, you know, we got a rescue company coming, we got a command officer rolling. It's everything's fairly simultaneous. So, you know, we've got, you know, the mobile communication terminals and the apparatus. This information is being regurgitated back from communications over those, you know, easy access to information for our folks. It's a little different for you. You got some folks that are showing up, you know, a little later, bringing apparatus, bringing, you know, personal vehicles to the scene. This initial size up and radio report, you know, how does that play into the operations that you have? I know it's got to be just as critical.
I would probably even say more so, somewhat, because of the issues you just brought up about the sporadic and the way we have our firefighters sometimes arrive at the scene. We do try to concentrate and have our personnel come to the station and respond on an apparatus as much as possible. For safety reasons, the last 15 years I've been chief, though, we do not let any of our volunteers have a red light or siren on their POVs. I just believe that's one thing the fire service itself and the volunteer service should do and take a stand on, to address the overwhelmingly high numbers of volunteer firefighters being injured and killed responding to calls, is take a proactive approach and not let volunteers have red lights and sirens in their vehicles. And since I'll get off my soapbox on that, but yes, it does play into the size up. But I would even go back a step further. One of the things we try to do as a volunteer department is once a month is go around on one of our drill nights and pick a handful of target hazards and structures, because I believe size up actually starts before you even get the call. You really have to have an idea of the buildings and the target hazards in your response area. And we do have laptops ourselves and our trucks and all that, and we have access to pre-plans. But like you said, a lot of our people are pulling up on the scene and they don't have access to all that. It may be on the first in company and it may be in my chief's response vehicle, but it's not at the access, easy access of every firefighter showing up. So I really think it starts there. But absolutely, when your first arriving officer or engine company arrives on scene, the most clear and concise size up that they can give the other responding personnel does set the tone with apparatus placement on how you're going to initiate and begin your fire operations and how successful that incident is going to be.
Well, I definitely agree. And it leads us right into the beginning of operations. And again, I opened up by saying we're putting lines on the ground, and that's how that incident's going to go. The thought process of assembling tools, as I will call them, putting things together, you know, looking and doing a little research for this, I know that something really disturbed me, and it's that when we begin looking at some of the recent trends that have contributed to firefighter fatalities, is that we're seeing folks, and I see this all the time, you know, going different places and doing training, being involved in operations over the years, is that we enter buildings a lot of times ill-equipped. And the first ill-equipped component that I really want to bring out, we talked about a little bit a couple of podcasts ago with Les Stevens from out in Texas, is that I think we sometimes take a knife to a gunfight, in a sense. We're pulling these typical small lines because we're always pulling inch and three-quarter hose lines on, you know, most of our calls because it's easily, to, you know, maneuverable, it's easy to operate, you know, or smaller numbers of people can do it. But I think sometimes that tool is what's hampering us in a fire suppression operation, is that we chose the wrong tool. Maybe we should have chose a larger line or a nozzle that's capable of flowing more water. What's your thoughts on that?
I would have to agree with you. And actually, the one part on the apparatus placement that we kind of didn't talk about is actually having to do, I think, the other key part on your apparatus placement is where your truck is and the length of your lines and the type of lines you're going to need to deploy to fight that fire. And that all ties in with your apparatus placement, because if your truck is in the wrong position, you may not have enough of the line that you need to get to the point to where the fire actually is. And if you get to that point to where you're having to shut a line down and extend a line, we all know how that starts adding time to our operation. But I couldn't agree more. One of the things that we try to really concentrate on, if we pull up and we really have a fire that is three-quarters to fully involved, we really discourage pulling off any of the small lines in the beginning. The last two instances where we had some structure fires that were three-quarter or fully involved, the first lines we were pulling off were pre-connects. And in one instance, even considering, you should consider if you have a straight pipe deck gun and you can get a water supply pretty good, quick to go ahead and use that as well. But two and a halves are a little more difficult and cumbersome to deploy, but they do offer such a significant increase in water flow capabilities, and not to mention the reach that the two and a half has compared to an inch and three quarter. If you're dealing with a large fire in a big building, a lot of times we, like you were mentioning, we're going in without the proper tools, but sometimes we're going in when we probably shouldn't go in. If you can get right by the door and inside the door and see what kind of progress you're making without advancing all the way into that structure, and especially if you have a two and a half, you may be able to reach and knock down some significant fire without even putting yourself really in any further danger by extending yourself into the building.
I couldn't agree more. One of the things that I saw that has occurred, I guess, you know, in doing some of this research, is recently what we're beginning to see is that these buildings are failing much quicker. The building construction design, we're gluing buildings together, we're making disposable buildings in a sense. So if we burn them down, it's really okay. That's what they designed them for, is to throw them away after about 10 years. And when I think about our attacks, and let's talk about attacks, and I'm right now in the midst of the volunteer department that I serve with in Ruffin, you know, we're doing a fire control class. And that was part of what we discussed the last night is, you know, going back to the attacks, going back to my home state, Lloyd Lehman, when he came up with all the fog nozzle and, you know, doing the indirect attack type approach, all that research that was done, I think what we have done is we've thrown all of the technology that we have, all the bits of information that we can choose from, we've just kind of pushed them to the side and went with one philosophy, and that was that aggressive, you know, hardcore push interior. And I think engine companies today and engine company tactics and beginning operations have to begin opening their toolboxes up. And I think about pulling, you know, a couple of drawers open of tactics of, you know, can, like you said, can we reach the fire from the door without making entry? Are we making good progress? You know, can we attack the fire, you know, quickly with this indirect or combination attack, you know, from an exterior portion of the building to get a little better understanding of what we're up against and, you know, how fast that a building may fail. You know, over the past, I guess, 3 or 4 months, I've seen incidents in Charlotte to where what looks like, you know, just seeing a little room and content fires that don't look like a whole lot from the outside have shown, you know, very quick structural style collapses that, you know, put firefighters in pretty, you know, quick danger. And, you know, Charlotte is just one because, you know, they're not too far down the road that you see that. But we go back and look at, you know, several cases over, you know, the past couple of years. I think this plays in the engine company operations. I think because they're delegated with this task of fire attack, we really need to be examining and looking real close of what we're doing and how we do it.
Well, I think one instance, and I couldn't agree more, is I think a lot of the information that's starting to come out now, and I actually just received something within the last day, and I attended a class at NFA on fire modeling, and for the chiefs and company officers that have an opportunity, they really need to start focusing on reading these reports and watching research that the companies and UL and people are doing with fire modeling. If you're really not paying attention, you're going to be behind the curve. And a lot of that has to tie in with a lot of the issues where we've been seeing recently with the floor joist issues with the wood and eye joist that are coming, that's been coming out the last several months and investigating, and the weakness of these floor joists when you're fighting fire in these buildings that you're not really sure. The foundations and the floors and the ceilings are not what they used to be because of the way that they're using these new engineered wood eye joists that have the particle board in between. So the reality is when we're pulling up on scene and you want to do aggressive firefighting in one hand, that's great. But the other thing we have to consider when you look at these fire models, the way that buildings are burning in 8, 10, and 12-minute increments, and as much as they're burning, that's about the time when we're getting a 911 call and we're responding and arriving on scene. And it looks good to get in there and knock a fire down in one or two rooms, but some of it you have to consider. You really need to pay more close attention to that construction and what the building's made of and what the floor joists are made of. We've had several tragedies, I'm sure you're well aware of more than I am, considering the line of work you're in and the instruction you do on firefighter safety with the issues of floor collapse and us losing firefighters lately. And we're running right in the door in the first 2 minutes on scene and sometimes not even having RIT teams in place and putting our people in tough positions.
You're exactly right. And I'm going to kind of jump around here just a hair and talk about making entry. You know, we have the OSHA rules out that talk about, you know, rapid intervention. NFPA 1500 is out there that addresses rapid intervention. And initially, early on, people don't recognize this, but, you know, there's really a reason why we establish initial, you know, RITs before we make entry, is because, you know, again, let's just talk about your operation. You're pulling up with just a couple of folks. So it's real easy to want to get aggressive because you're waiting on people and do something. But on the other hand, how fast things are changing in the dynamics of fire today, is imperative that we focus on getting an initial writ company in place before we make that interior. So I think part of our tactics has to change a little bit and make sure that we adhere to that so that we do have, you know, things in place. And, of course, you know, teaching rapid intervention like I have for, you know, many years, two people outside is not a true RIT team. It meets the standard. It becomes a reconnaissance team. If something happens, they might be able to facilitate, you know, for a fairly, you know, low-level self-rescue. But we know it's going to take 12 to 16 people to get somebody out that's truly in trouble. And, you know, on a lot of folks, we're seeing that there's not 16 people on the scene. In rural America, we're seeing the large majority of our companies fighting fires with, you know, 8-10 people tops on the scene. I'm sure you've experienced that.
Yes, sir. And kind of since we've been kind of focusing on this one incident, the fire we had at the condo, that was a three-story unit that was three-quarters involved when we arrived on scene. We ended up having, they found out after, we had 9 people in one condominium. And some of the chaos when a handful of the people were outside when we first arrived, a little while into the incident, after some of it started coming together well and you got things going, and even myself, I learned a lot. Chief Gassaway just recently had a class here in Georgia at our Chiefs Conference about command and the things you have to focus on. And a lot of times when you're a volunteer chief like myself, you don't realize sometimes you're missing things, because in that instance, on that scene, I was helping get a supply line hooked up and pull a line, and you truly can't be in command and pay attention to the radio and all the conditions and everything when you're actually having to function and perform and help. But that's the way it is in part of our world. But one of the things is some of the people outside were not exactly completely understanding why we just didn't arrive on scene and run right into the building with the 2 or 3 people we had and started putting a fire out. And I had to somewhat explain to them later on, that is not the way we operate. We cannot operate that way. It's against the law, and not only that, it's completely unsafe for our personnel. And I did take a few minutes and explain to them the 2 in and 2 out and our RIT concept of why we don't send 2 people in no matter what. I know there is rare occurrences where there may be a potential life safety issue where you may be able to make that save, but that's a very fine line that you have to make that judgment on sending people in. Is that life inside, even if you know it's in there, is it savable? And is it worth your 2 firefighters to make that save? So they were a little more understanding after you explained to them that you need to assemble the necessary people on scene before we entered that building. And a lot of people just need, a lot of paid departments that I watch that are bigger departments, they're 10 and 15 minutes into incidents before they have RIT teams even established. And I don't understand that myself personally, when you can pull up in 8 minutes and have 3 engines and a ladder and 20 people on scene and you have everybody doing something besides a RIT team.
Well, and I think a lot of it will fall to discipline and focus. I don't think that they're truly disciplined and focused on some of the things that they need to be. That's almost a whole other issue, so I'll kind of stay away from that a little bit. But we're about halfway through, Carl. So far, I think we've had a great program for our folks. We got a lot more coming up. We want our listeners to stay tuned as we take a break. And we'll be back with Training and Tactics Talk. And we're going to talk about, in the second half, some hose line operations and some considerations there. So stay tuned. We'll be back with Training and Tactics Talk in just a moment.
Radio at firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
Welcome back to Training and Tactics Talk. We're talking today on some engine company operations. On board with me is Carl Smith, chief from down in Georgia at Thunderbolt Fire Department. And the first half, we've really nailed down some placement. We've talked about some operations, some considerations, you know, into our size up. We began talking about our tools, and one of our tools being the hose line. I'll pick up with making sure we talk a little more about some tools that we need to have on board with us as we begin, you know, our initial operations. But I want to continue with some hose line talk. And we know that hose line advancement is probably one of the hardest and most frustrating things that we do on a fire ground, especially if we don't have enough manpower. It gets hung up, and, you know, trying to drag hose or move hose. The amount of furniture and things that are in homes today, the design factor of how they do the architectural pieces to, you know, buildings and homes is frustrating. So there's always been this ongoing, you know, conversation of wet, you know, hose lines versus dry hose line advancements. I'm going to kind of lead off on this a little bit, Carl, and say that I think both of them are desperately needed. But I think that a lot of times we hamper our operations, especially with folks that are not used to doing dry hose line advancements because of their comfort level. And I know that frequently, you know, in bigger operations where you got to go into multiple floors or into large, you know, buildings to where you might advance a little farther, we do some dry operations. From your perspective, what do you see, advantage, disadvantage here? You know, what's the thought process that you have running an organization with dry and wet hose line advancements?
Actually, that's an interesting question. We actually have certain situations where that's pretty much somewhat what we have to do to effectively deploy lines for certain fires at our waterfront industrial and marina areas. Advancing a charged line down docks and around boat yards and facilities and stuff like that really is very, very difficult if you try to do it as much. And it can be done, but it is a lot easier and less cumbersome if you practice and stretch the hose lines out dry and get them pretty much 80 to 90% in position before you do charge the line. A lot of those lays we have, each one of our trucks, we actually have extended lays set up on our rear discharge just for our marinas to where if we have to pull up and pull a line off to stretch down one of these docks several hundred feet to get to a boat. So we have a little bit of experience and actually train and practice with that a little bit. In residential and commercial, really not a whole lot of experience with that. A lot of times it is wet lines. We do have a few bigger warehouses, of course, like you mentioned, where you may want to deploy based on where you're attacking the fire from. You want to try to stretch and take as much of the strain off your firefighters while you're getting that line in position to save some of their energy for the actual firefighting itself by being able to deploy that dry line and without the weight, of course, and the difficulty in stretching and all the movement in it. So in that instance, I could see that. In the other case, sometimes when you're fighting fires on multi-stories, multi-level buildings, multi-story buildings, the dry line is definitely sometimes an advantage if they're not going right into the room that's involved and you're just trying to, of course, get up the ladder and get into position. And once you get your crew inside and they're up the ladder and off the ladder charging that line, sometimes it's a lot safer.
Well, I definitely agree because I use the philosophy, you know, when I'm making those decisions, or especially when I was a firefighter or a company officer, it's where do we have to go or where are we going, you know, how are we going to get there, and, you know, how many people do we have to help us do that? The last piece of that is probably the most important. You know, if I got to move hose line, you know, a fair distance, you have to really consider, you know, your personnel. So when I think about this, let's kind of look at this. Let's talk about some dry stretches here. What's some advantages? We know that it allows for a more rapid hose deployment. We know that you can position it, like you said, much better and with a whole lot less effort. And that allows your advancing crew to be able to do more fire operations and be fresher, which to me is a big safety issue. You know, we get these people wore out, and then we ask them to engage in, you know, battle. You know, that's very tough because they're already pre-fatigued. You know, a disadvantage or a couple of these disadvantages to me is that as you're setting up with the rapid fire phenomenon the way it is, and, of course, you going just through fire modeling, we've seen that, and they're beginning to show this more and more, and we can see it more and more just on regular fires of just how unpredictable this fire is and how it will take off in this rapid growth that, you know, just all of a sudden, you know, it's like, whoa. And when we get, you know, some predictable ventilation, such as failures of windows, we throw the wind in, we begin having some problems because we don't have the ability to protect ourselves instantaneously with a hose line or be able to change that. And you mentioned that. Now, with our wet stretches, you know that it's definitely going to be the safest as far as the most common, I guess, against fire attack. But when we talk about safety, again, you know, I sling that back at the dry, you know, there are appropriate times. And again, I go back to the toolbox thing. You know, wet stretch allows us to, you know, immediately flow water. It reduces kinking and hanging, you know, potentially putting yourself in a bad position. Because with a dry line, it's easy to get it kinked up or under a door and you wouldn't know it. And then that door is going to, you know, if it's underneath the bottom of the door, acts just like a hose clamp. So there's some disadvantages there, you know, that we run into. I think you threw out a couple of good points there that are indicative of where you're at. And I think about rural America. In Ruffin, we have places that you can't even get a fire apparatus to. You can't get down the driveways or across, you know, a small bridge. So now we're stretching large amounts of hose to be able to set up just for operations. You know, the places in the urbanized arena is that you have these, you know, homes that, you know, are offset from the road, you know, significantly versus what you described in one of your fires as being, you know, 6-8 feet off the road. So I think we have to begin evaluating things more and more. And just how much time or how much effort do you think we need to be focusing on, not only with our company officers, but our firefighters, of being able to make these strong, hardcore decisions for effective fire attack with choosing, like, the right tool? How much time are you seeing people spend, and how much time are you spending?
I guess we try as much as you can. I'm sure you do. It's a balancing game that's very difficult when you have such a fluid situation as ours in a volunteer department, where we have people come and go and join and leave. Our officer corps does change somewhat regularly, but we try to keep some of the core group intact as much as possible. And we really try to focus half our drill time that we have drills in at least like once a month on officer stuff, to focus them on tactics and size up and operations. And you mentioned a good point. We're down here in the South, and you're well aware we have the same issue with, we have a very narrow, we have narrow roads and people that live down long dirt roads that have oak trees overhanging the road, and there is no fire trucks going down that road. And we're in the position where we have to constantly talk about the way to deploy the supply lines and the attack lines. I mean, we actually still, believe it or not, train and doing reverse lays and stuff like that because of some of the situations that we have in a few of our areas with the water source being so far away down a dirt road from a structure that's down a long dirt road. So those are the things you really have to have, to me, integrated in your training thing, and you have to do those things with your pre-plans and those kind of situations at least once a month. You need to talk about them and go over and remind your people, hey, remember about this address. If you get a call there, you're not going to be able to take your truck down this driveway, and if you have a call here, you're going to have to deploy 250 feet of dry line. And that's really up to your company officers and your training officers. They really have to stay focused with everything we have going on and all the stuff you're trying to keep up on and the changing things day to day, to remember some of those basics and keep your people, your core group, as much informed and knowledgeable as possible.
Oh, I definitely agree with that. And while we're here talking about equipment, let's kind of go back to other pieces that we need. I see firefighters entering buildings, and they're not taking axes or halogen bars or pipe poles or or flashlights, or even what we asked for years was our ability to be able to see through the smoke with the thermal imaging cameras. I think we're going in almost without the right tools or the right equipment, or what I will call ill-prepared, in a sense, for the battle we're engaging in. I see it all the time. I see folks enter without axes or halogen bars. I see, you know, thermal imaging cameras that remain on the rigs and never get out of the cases or out of the chargers on the initial operation. And I personally think that this is, one, a training issue, but two, also a cultural issue, something that, you know, as people have been around a while, a lot of this stuff gets added in. And I also think that we limit, you know, a little bit of this because we say we don't have enough hands. But there are alternative ways of carrying equipment. I just don't think that we get as creative as possible. What's your thought process, and what have you been seeing, Carl?
I could not agree more. One of the things that is so very difficult in what we're trying to do is use the tools that we fight for, like you mentioned, and get, and especially the thermal camera. That is one thing that I think that we have to turn the notch up on. Our guys, especially our paid firefighters, when they arrive on scene, if they have a working fire and they're assembling their attack team, they are mandated that the first in crew has a tick camera in their hand. It does not make any sense at all when that tool can do so much for the initial team going in a building that can help them identify, look, search, locate significantly faster in a working fire, especially those that have a lot of incomplete combustion, that have a lot of thick, heavy black smoke. There is no reason why our personnel are not using those tick cameras to the best of their ability going in and helping these situations get resolved a whole lot faster than the old method of going in on your hands and knees and feeling and trying to look and search and doing it the old way. We don't have to do that if you have a tick camera. I know we still have a lot of departments that don't. Our department actually only has two, so our first-in team takes it, and then our RIT team gets the second camera. But absolutely, and you mentioned no taking of irons, no tools. We really try to stress to our guys, we actually buy the little pry axes, the individual pry axes for each person to have to carry in. There are so many circumstances, and you're more well-versed in this than I am. We try to teach our people safety and survival techniques, but just the one little personal pry axe could help you if you're stuck anywhere in a building to try to get through a wall or something like that. So you're absolutely right, and it comes down to training. And if you don't make your people train that way, they're certainly not going to operate that way when they get to an emergency and all chaos is breaking loose.
Well, I agree. And one of the things that I am seeing, and I have some of the same, I guess, heartburn in a sense as you were describing, is people not using the cameras and seeing that. And I think we come back to one key component, and you hit on it with training. A couple of weeks ago, I had the opportunity to be down at the Southeastern Fire School and at the South Carolina Fire Academy. And I teamed up with an old colleague of mine, Aubrey Hyde, out of Virginia. And we did situational awareness with thermal imaging cameras. And we truly found that people did not understand thermal imaging. They didn't understand the capabilities. They didn't understand the utilization. I also found that people became very fixated on that screen. They were just, their attention was, they were like a moth to a flame or to a light. They went straight to that camera screen, and they were just hung up on that. And, you know, that's kind of bad. So one of the things that we were able to do with this group of people, I think, were provide them with a great opportunity to understand, you know, really utilizing and reading thermal imaging technology. I think that's something that we need to put some more focus on. And there are programs out there that help with that. But I think you hit on some good stuff about the smaller tools that are available and carrying things in. We definitely have to do that. Moving along, there's some coordination that has to go into some of this to kind of wrap up today's component with some engine company operations. We have to coordinate not only fire attack, but oftentimes search and rescue. We have to coordinate with other folks for ventilation. You know, how difficult is this really for a department that, you know, is rolling in with a limited amount of people for you?
It is very difficult for us to begin to assemble. You always have a game plan in your head as an incident commander. And as a bigger department, you already know the tools and the resources. You know, when they come on shift at 8 o'clock, you know who's on engine 3 and who's on engine 4. Let's not forget personal accountability systems with engine company operations and in all of our facets, about making sure from the beginning we get on scene that we keep track of our people and do the best we can to make sure we know where they are at all times.
Absolutely. Well, Carl, I think we've covered a lot of stuff in today's program, and I'm very pleased with the information that we've brought out for our listeners. And one of the things we do want to do for our listeners is, if you have any questions or comments, you can always contact us at radio@firehouse.com and send those in. We'd love to answer those for you. In fact, we've, you know, actually even developed an entire podcast off of it for our listeners to try to answer, you know, some very serious questions that our folks out there on the streets, you know, may have. And that's the whole focus of Training and Tactics Talk, is to put the right information out onto the streets so that we enhance not only our skills and our knowledge, but our opportunities to be safer. And our whole goal is to ensure that everyone goes home. Carl, thank you for being on the show with us today. It's an honor and a privilege to work with you again in a different capacity than what we've worked together with over the last couple of years. And I think you've provided some insight to our listeners of some different perspectives, and you're definitely in the same ball game as many of our listeners in being in a small combination to rural department. So thank you again for being on board.
Well, thank you, Chief Klein. It's been an honor. I appreciate you and Firehouse allowing me to do this. And let's just hope that everyone, if they can just learn one thing from what we talked about and make their department safe, and, you know, Godspeed, and let's hope we get through, you know, a day, a week, and a month without any firefighter fatalities.
Absolutely. Well, you've been listening to Training and Tactics Talk on radio at firehouse.com. We're glad you tuned in, and you don't want to miss next month as we move forward and continue our true tactics component with our training facet behind that. And we'll look forward to having you on board as we come back next month talking more about training and tactics with engine company operations, and beginning to move forward with more tactics. They're going to focus in on some truck company operations in the very near future. So you folks stay tuned, and we'll see you next month. Thanks for joining.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these, or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.